had a real long day. It's like I got this morning. It's like, and things got up, and then after you got up.
All the one. We just did that. You weren't here this morning. We missed out on a lot of very esoteric points. Like this. There were ugly varticas. A dreadful sight, having one wing, one eye, and one leg. So one wonders if that's something to do with if they're purple in color and they eat people because they have one wing, so obviously they fly. I'm not sure, but I'm saying about the point of the modern one-eyed, one-horned, flying purple people eating. So get these things. We had a big discussion on grits, how you get grits. Okay.
Hari Om Sahana Bhavatu Sahana Bhunaktu Saha Viryankara Vavahai Tejasvinavadhi Tamastu Ma Vidvishavahai Om Shanti 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 Om Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shri Vasari Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare.
Okay. So in establishing that the souls are simultaneously one and different, then Sutra 14, some say the individual soul are the supreme, others say the individual souls are different from the supreme. Still others say that the individual souls are both one and different from the supreme. Right? And so then it's been established that there's like the Lord and the soul are there, and so they're in the same kind of situation, but there's a difference. The living entity is involved in trying to enjoy the material energy, the Lord is not. And so there's a oneness, but there's a difference. Right? So someone who understands this, then he is freed from everything. One who understands the position of the Lord in relationship with the Lord, he is the best of the transcendentalists. So it's not only alluding to the point of that you understand the Lord, but that you understand him in devotion. That makes the highest. So those who understand, that's they're transcendentalists. But one who understands in devotion, they're the highest. Right, but because there's so many of these different approaches, then now it comes up. Here someone may say, the conflicting claims of these different philosophies will certainly bewilder the living beings, living entities' minds. Fearing that someone would say this, the author of the sutras proceeds to explain that there is no real conflict among these seemingly conflicting views. They are separate aspects of a single philosophy. Right? It means it's one philosophy, it's different aspects. You're looking at the various viewpoints, right? But they're not separated so much as Nimbarkacharya's Dwait Advait, right? Because there it is two perspectives on one philosophy, but they're not simultaneous. They're exclusively of each other. But here, then, what makes it more confusing is that it's inclusive. So now, understanding this may come up, now he brings this point. Next point, Sutra 15. All are true, because the evidence of Scripture is always true, and because the seeming conflict does not bewilder they who know the truth. Right? There's a seeming contradiction in Shastra, then as was pointed out by here, by Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, and as pointed out in the Shastra itself, there is no contradiction. It's a seeming contradiction. Right? That's why it's always said that seeming contradictions, because there isn't any. It's just different viewpoints on the same thing. Right? You know, somebody's talking about the smell of the apple, someone else is talking about how you cook it. So you may say they're contradictory. Right? You know, someone's saying that, you know, the apple has a particular smell and all that, and the fragrance, and that's important. Someone else is saying, well, after you cut it, you have to add lemon. But then that would change the smell. You'd lose that, you know. So one is talking about cooking it, one is talking about the natural flavor. You understand? So in here there's no contradiction because they're still talking about dealing with apples. And they're dealing with the nature of the apples. Right? Does that make sense? So this is very important to note, is that you can have these different perspectives and there not be a problem. Right? Because in the spiritual world, the souls are not manifest in a conditional state, they're in the constitutional state. So the common point is all servant of Krishna. But at the same time, being individual, they have a completely different perspective on something than another soul. Right? A unique, let's say, unique perspective. So those with a common, a workably common, unique perspective, they're in one group. And those where the perception is different enough, that puts them in a different group. But the commonality is Krishna. Right? The oneness is pleasing Krishna. The difference is how they're going to please Krishna, what they see as how to best please Krishna. Right? So one has to be able to accommodate this, because you'll deal with that in the spiritual world. That's why then amongst devotees, one is not so worried about the difference. Right? You're more worried about what's the same, that service to Krishna. Does that make sense? Like that. Commentary by Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur. All these sages are correct because they who know the truth of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and understand these conflicting views are aspects of single philosophy, are not bewildered. These differentiating views are also correct because the previously quoted passages of Shruti Shastra, passages that are evidence for these different views, must all be correct. That is the meaning, right? In other words, the Shastras are saying these things that seem to be different. They're talking about the oneness. They're talking about the difference. They're talking about, you know, whatever that means, the oneness and difference. So all these are correct because the Shastra talks about it. If the Shastra didn't talk about it, it wouldn't be correct. It wouldn't be considered. But Shastra is talking about it, so it must be able to be accommodated. Therefore, when you're studying Prabhupada's books, and then you get into conversations and letters, there many times seem to be contradictory points, right? But you have to be able to understand, is there different perspectives on the same point? They're not different. So one has to learn this anyway. It's not a matter of, well, I'm fine the way I am now. Great, as long as you have this. If you don't have this, it has to be developed, because it's something you're going to be using basically eternally. You have to be able to accommodate different perspectives and varieties of things on one absolute truth, right? Because there's only Krishna, there's only one topic, Krishna, right? Krishna is the supreme subject. There isn't another subject, right? But so all other subjects are in line with the supreme subject. These seeming other aspects of the subject may seem contradictory, but it's still about one subject, not about something else. Does that make sense? That is the meaning. Okay. In Srimad Bhagavatam 11.22.4, the Supreme Personality of Godhead declares, quote, "All such philosophers spoke under the shelter of my mystic potency, and thus they could say anything without contradicting the truth." So it means this is 11th canto, so there you're having all kinds of different personalities talk. You have the python sadhu talking like that. You have Pingala, the prostitute, talking. All different personalities. You have Nimi, now Maharaj Nimi, who's speaking to Nimi? People I and I? I think so. They were all speaking like this. So different, the Kumaras speak. So all personalities are speaking. So how is it that there seems to be so many different angles of vision? Because they're all being empowered by the Lord. And so they're not contradictory. It's just the Lord is so broad and so and limited that there's unlimited perspectives. And so we may only be able to see some of those. So those ones that we see, that's what's important for us. Those we don't see are not. But these are important. So even if we don't see this way, we have to learn to see this way. It's something that's important for us as Gaudiya Vaishnavas, right? It works for anybody, but specifically we have to think like this. Does that make sense? Like that. In Taittiriya Upanishad 3.1.1, it is said, "All created beings emanate from the absolute truth, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. By his power they remain alive. They attain him at the end." Okay, so all are coming from Krishna. That means the differences in all these different beings is still coming from Krishna. Because Krishna being the absolute truth, he's the source of all qualities. So whatever qualities are there in the individual soul is still qualities of Krishna. Right? Just different balances and proportions and all that. Right? And so it is he that is their life, and it is he who they obtain. So the qualities they have are coming from Krishna, right? how they're maintaining themselves, how they're going about their activities is Krishna, and the ultimate goal. So the sambandha, abhideya, and prayojana of the living entities is still Krishna. That makes sense? They are who they are because of Krishna. They're able to do what they do and are maintained because of Krishna, and in the end they attain Krishna. Like that. So now, then Srila Prabhupada explains. In the introduction to Sri Upanishad, Srila Prabhupada explains the same truth. Quote, "This is the Vedic principle and we accept it. Vedic principles are accepted as axiomatic truth, for there cannot be any mistake. That is acceptance. For instance, in India, cow dung is accepted as pure, and yet cow dung is the stool of an animal. In one place you find the Vedic injunction that if you touch stool, you have to take a bath immediately. But in another place it is said that the stool of a cow is pure. If you smear cow dung in an impure place, that place becomes pure. With our ordinary sense, we can argue, this is contradictory. Actually, it is contradictory from the ordinary point of view, but it is not false, it is fact." Right? So here he's making the ordinary point of view. So if you're using ordinary, your intelligence, mundane intelligence, to try to understand everything, that is the ordinary point of view, right? Now, if you're within the ordinary point of view, right, then you make gradations. Right, and so someone who's more intelligent, more logical, more perceptive, that will be, you know, better ordinary. And someone to that degree that they're not logical, not perceptive, you know, then they'll be less, you know, quality ordinary. Does that make sense? So, but compared to actual spiritual intelligence, where you're dealing with the absolute truth as handed down by the sages, that is a different kind of intelligence, right? That's superior. So this is very ordinary point of view. Does that make sense? Because otherwise, because they will be considered within mundane intelligence quite respected, they'll consider their view is the top. No, it's the top of ordinary. Does that make sense? Like that. You know, it's like the example is given is that if you're going to train a living entity to be a pig, right? It's not that you can't take someone who's been a human and just stick them immediately into a pig body. They won't appreciate it, right? So the Yamadutas take this living entity and don't feed him anything for a long time, right? And then when he's, you know, hungry enough, then they start feeding him stool, right? But they feed him the worst qualities of stool, right? And so it's very disturbing. But after a while, he gets adjusted with it. He doesn't like it, but he's adjusted with it. Then they feed him better quality of stool, and he goes, oh, this is nice, right? And as soon as that's there, then they put him in the pig's body. You understand? So within there, that thing, then they're making distinction. You understand? So in the same way as within the mundane sphere, the mundane intellectuals and academics, they are working on ordinary perspective. They just may be very expert at it, or very spontaneous in it, or very, what do you call it? It's along with spontaneous, you know, able to think of very nice things with it.
What?
Creative, innovative. Like that. But it's still the ordinary perspective. You know what I'm saying? Like that. So, that's all. So the sages, their perspective is different. They can accommodate all these at once and see that there's no problem. Like that. Because if it has to be in little boxes like this, you're always going to have a problem because nothing is in little boxes. Right? You see little boxes around here? Right? They're on your computer. They're on your little pieces of paper with little arrows and lines and little, but that's where they are. They're not there. You know what I'm saying? So this is the problem. In the purport to Mantra 5, it is stated, quote, "Here is a description of some of the Supreme Lord's transcendental activities, executed by his inconceivable potencies.
The contradictions given here prove the inconceivable potencies of the Lord. He walks and he does not walk. Ordinarily, if someone can walk, it is illogical to say he cannot walk. But in reference to God, such a contradiction simply serves to indicate his inconceivable power. With our limited fund of knowledge, we cannot accommodate such contradictions. And therefore, we conceive of the Lord in terms of our limited powers of understanding. For example, the impersonalist philosopher of the Mayavad school accept only the Lord's impersonal activities and reject his personal feature. But the members of the Bhagavat school, adopting the perfect conception of the Lord, accept his inconceivable potencies and thus understand that he is both personal and impersonal. Right? So here's another example of both at once. He walks, he does not walk. So he's saying here that they can only conceive of the Lord according to their, in terms of our limited powers of understanding, right? If we remember, Bhaktivinoda Thakur is making this point, is all these mundane religions like that, you know, impersonal, Mayavad included, that they're all working, whether they're into the, extinction of the soul, or whether they're simply into sense enjoyment. In either case, they're only working from their mundane perception. What they know of this world, that they're putting together and creating their philosophy. Right? They do not know what is transcendental, so how can their philosophy be transcendental? They know mundane, they could only... So then here we see this same thing. Therefore, we conceive the Lord in terms of our limited powers of understanding. So that means we're limited powers means it's mundane. We can only perceive the material. And so what we are able to perceive of the material, that much, then we have a philosophy. And because of that, we're attracted to this philosophy, or this lifestyle or that, because of our limited perception based on our conditioned nature. Does that make sense? So even if they say they're liberated, they're free, but that's still a mundane, limited concept, that the soul is going to be free from, you know, activity, free from consciousness, free from, their connection with God, free from existence. All these things are illusory. So in illusion, they come up with these other things. Just, it sounds like better illusion. That's all. It's just better illusion, that's all. It's not anything different. It's still illusion. Probably gives the example of you're being bound by a gold chain instead of by an iron chain, so you think you're a superior prisoner. You know? Check out my bling, you know, it's like that. Yours is just, you know, iron, right? So does that make sense? So that is the difficulty, is that due to their own conceptions, is there. Do we understand what's happening like that? Plus, we also see is that Prabhupada says all the things that the acharyas say. There's nothing he leaves out, no points. Just he uses a language that is able to be understandable, because these points are very technical. So you say them in a very simple way, then you can catch the simplest aspect of it. Right? Because the point is this. Someone who has less understanding will gain the most by a simple explanation. Right? Someone who is, and if something's a very complex explanation, they won't understand it. But someone who can appreciate the complex points can also appreciate them when they're stated simply. Right? In fact, that's considered to be very eloquent. Right? So that way, the best position is using simple, straightforward language, because everybody can appreciate it. You know what I'm saying? Like that. Right? The neophyte will appreciate the simplicity of it. Like that, the easy access. The Madhyama will appreciate the straightforwardness, right? And the Uttama will appreciate the poetics,
right? Because that simplicity, it makes it poetic. It's just so nicely stated. Does that make sense? So everything is there in this, but then some people, that's a side point, but some people, because of this, take it that Prabhupada doesn't talk technical things. But that's why we're putting Prabhupada's purports after, instead of before, like it's written in this book. Because if we do it before, you'll think, okay, here's the simple thing, and then now we'll get the complexity spoken by Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur. But we're putting it the other way, so you can see it's all those complexities that Bhaktivinoda Thakur is explaining. Srila Prabhupada is very, very simply, in a very pleasant way, stated them in his purports. Right? So it makes it accessible. Right? It just, there's subtleties. Right? So if it doesn't mean anything to you, it has some meaning to you. It always has some meaning. But as one goes, there's deeper, deeper meaning. That's why one can read one of Prabhupada's books, and then after a short time, read it again. And it'll feel as if you've never read it before, because there's so many new points like that. That makes sense? Because so much is there. It's just stated very simply. Okay. So then the materialist can only accept the mundane side. Right? Means they're looking at the personal, but not actually in connection with the Lord. So they're taking the supremacy of the Lord, but attributing that to the material energy. Because the Lord's potency is coming through the material energy, so they take it that the material is supreme. Right? So you get all your materialistic, philosophies this way. The impersonalist, knowing that the material energy is not actually what is supreme, then they take all the activity that is being there, the potencies of the Lord, as being as mundane, and the same as them, so they take it that spiritual means beyond that. So then they reject all the forms. So then they accept the impersonal form of the Lord. So at least they've taken it a step further, right? Instead of seeing it as mundane, they're able to actually distinguish. But they're not able to see the Lord within it. So only the Vaishnavas, they can appreciate the Lord, how he as a person has all the qualities. He can, on the transcendental platform with his internal potency, perform all activities. At the same time as the material energy is being empowered with his potencies. And so therefore it works, right? But at the same time, he's not involved. In other words, people walk here because of the Lord's potency of the ability to walk. But he is not walking here. Right? It's being carried out with material energy. He walks in the spiritual world. You know what I'm saying? So because this is Upanishad, it's not going to come down to the mundane. Right? It's not going to explain that. That's for the Karmakandi. That will be in the Purva Mimamsa. But this being Uttara Mimamsa, it's Upanishad, so it'd be the latter. So it's just going to talk about Bhagavat, the Bhagavat and Brahman. It's not going to talk about the mundane. Does that make sense? Other than the Lord has empowered it in that. It won't get into detail. That's for the other Vedic literatures. Right? What's not Paravidya. Right, the aparavidya, that explains how the Lord has entered it and then how we deal with that in interaction. So if we remember the Lord's part of it, it takes us to the para platform. If we don't, then it takes us into ignorance. Does that make sense? And the Upanishadic approach doesn't mean it doesn't include it. It just says it there. Then details are somewhere else. You know what I'm saying? It's just like it says, okay, then they got married. Right, the king then married this princess, right? So he doesn't have to say more, because they're just talking about the interactions and the storyline of that, in how the Lord and his devotees are interacting. But you want to know about marriage, there is a shastra that gets into all details about the marriage. And if you look at that, all details are connected to the Lord. You just have to be able to see. Does that make sense? But you can also not see.
Many people see it, and it's not see. I've seen devotees, when they take the Vedic, you know, how you say, rules on marriage that's given by Gopal Bhatta Goswami, right? You know, not known as a, you know, a slouch in spiritual understanding, and remove mantras because they feel they're mundane, right? There's a mantra, one of the famous ones, Kama Stuti, like that, where the husband or the groom touches the bride's heart. And then he says, you know, where is this love come from? Who is it for? Where is it going to? Love comes from love. Love goes through love. Goes to love. You know, through love then we have this relationship. So then they were saying, oh, this is just mundane love. But the point is you got dead matter here that you're marrying. Where did that potency of that attraction, everything come that's coming from the Lord? Where is it going? Back to the Lord. So it's just that it's coming from the Lord, it's going to the Lord. And the living entity, because of their attachments, is identifying with the mundane, so they think this is me, but it's not you. You understand? So everything about it is showing how the attraction, the attachments, the activities, everything is connected to the Lord. Otherwise, why would Gopal Bhatta Goswami get involved? He's showing how these samskaras can be directly connected to the Lord. Well, not directly, I mean how the Lord can be seen in them. It's still indirect connection. In our mind is direct, but we're going to do it through an activity that's not direct. Does that make sense? Like that. So that kind of thing then is, so the Uttarmimamsa, it'll just say, show its connection, but it won't show the detail of the mechanics of the connection. You know, I mean, how you apply it. Does that make sense? Right? And the Aranyakas, they will show the metaphysics that bridge the two. Technically, this is this, this is this, this is this, right? So it's through understanding the metaphysics you see, okay, here's the ritual explained in the Brahmana, right? Because then the Sakriya Star is coming from the Brahmanas. The Brahmanas, then that will give rise to your Agamas, and then in there you'll have your Gotamiya Tantra. That then is Gotamiya, is what we're using? No, Gobila Griha Sutra. That Gobila Griha Sutra, that then is being brought in line with our understanding. Right? So that's from the Brahmanas. Then through the metaphysics of what's going on there, of the Aranyakas, then we come to the Upanishadic conclusion. So even though you're performing the activity on the platform of the Brahmana, your understanding of it is that of the Upanishad. So you're getting a Vedantic result from your marriage. If you understand it that way. If you're not, you're getting a very pious, nice arrangement. Does that make sense? So that's what's being given. That's what the acharyas are showing. So that means these sages, they can see this. They can see how all these three can connect together very nicely. The physical, the metaphysical, and the spiritual. Right? Because it's all coming from the Lord. It's just various kinds of manifestations. Because of the variousness, there's also various perspectives. So you have to know these perspectives, but know how they combine, how they go together. Otherwise, if you only know one or the other, then there'll be a problem. Those who know the Upanishads can't relate to the, no one who knows this can't relate to that. You have to be able to bridge it. It's a part of one system. The sannyas, the brahmacharis, and the grihasas are one system. It's not different systems. But it's dealt with as if it's different systems. But it's one system. Right? So that's what the point is it's just the ordinary point of view is it's different systems, but this spiritual point of view is that it's different perspectives on one point. Right? Okay? Does that make sense? So based on that view, is that fine? Okay, now from that, after this description, Bhaktivinoda Thakur continues. After thus describing the true nature of the individual spirit souls, the author of the sutras proceeds to describe the renunciation of all wanted things. He also describes the means to obtain the highest goal in life. He says, okay, so now this will describe renunciation, how to describe renounce anything that's not useful in devotional service, and how to obtain, and the method that you're going to get the highest goal. Right? So, in other words, you're taking the activity of renouncing, but you're renouncing what? Things not useful. That means from the platform of action, abideya, you're going to correct what's not correct in the mundane sambandha and bring it to the spiritual. Right? And through that is that wherever situation you're in now that may have come from past, you know, activities based on the sambandha, abideya, and prayojana. Now through that, you're going to correct the future prayojana. Does that make sense? Like that. So whatever situation we're in, that we're going to deal with. Because otherwise, how do you deal with sambandha in sambandha? You have to deal with it from abideya, because that's where intelligence is being applied. Right? Does that make sense? Otherwise, it's just knowledge of the field. But this is where applied knowledge. So by applied knowledge, you can change the field. Right? Otherwise, you're simply understanding the field you're in and acting according to that. So if the field you're in is spiritual or has been spiritualized, then you follow that. If it's not, then through this process, you have to spiritualize the field. Does that make sense? So in other words, he's looking at this from the point of abideya. Sutra 16. The conscious spirit souls possess thinking and loving, for these two are part of their nature. Right? So that means your thinking is going to get rid of all unwanted things, and your loving is going to get you the highest goal in life. Right? They think about the mundane, they love the mundane, then you keep yourself here. You think about the material world in connection with Krishna, you have affection in connection with Krishna, that gets you the transcendental. Yes. Yes, that would be very also a good point. Thinking and so the mind and the intelligence are there. And so then the how you say? Means the mind is there, but it has to do things. So the mind means the mind is accepting and rejecting, but so you've accepted, so what? So unless you can do something about it, what's the meaning? So therefore the mind engages the senses. The senses are controlled by the intelligence. So that means the mind with the intelligence can see what can be done and not done. The mind will decide and then engage, right? And then ego is its position. You know, the mind's identity is the ego. Its method for getting things done is the intelligence, right? Does that make sense? Because technically it's just one thing, right? The subtle body is basically just the mind. But the mind has these three aspects: that which accepts and rejects, that which discerns, and that which is an identity. You know what I'm saying? So therefore it's given three different names. It's very important to understand this principle that the Vedic can have a overall, let's say, designation of a body of knowledge, and then within that body, same body of knowledge, have a part of it named by the same thing as the total. They always do this. Because, in other words, what is the point that is has the same name as the total, that's the important point. That's the central point. Right? Like in the Vedic concept of Jyotish. Right? Jyotish means astronomy. Right? Then you have six parts. You have Ganita, mathematics. Then you have Jyotish, which is astronomy. Then you have Jataka, which is your astrology. You know, then you have the Samudrika, which is like reading the body, like palm or forehead or, you know, thumbs or faces or feet or whatever it is that you like to do. Nimitta, which will be omens, and Prashna, based on question. So then basically you can say that there are three main parts. You've got the mathematical system by which you can do astronomy. And then by the position of the planets, the astrological position, those can be interpreted for the particular time, place, and circumstance you're in through the birth chart, omens, you know, how you say, Samudrika and Prashna. Does that make sense? So, but the important central feature is astronomy. Right? So that's why it has that name, because the whole science is Jyotish, and that part is called Jyotish. Then you see it in the proper perspective, because otherwise, then those who are really good in Jataka, they're in, you know, in astrology, they're going to turn the whole thing so that astrology is the central feature. And Jataka, astronomy is simply the mathematics of where the planets are. It means you have math and then you figure out from math where the planets are. Then you can do the real work, which is the charts. You understand? So therefore, they'll just call it Muhurta. Right? Does that make sense? They reduce the whole bigger science down to Muhurta. Right? So it's just their perspective. And they're very strong on this. Why? Because great person like Varahamihira and others have used this viewpoint like that, which is correct if you're looking at it from there. But the actual Vedic science is astronomy is the main. You understand? So therefore, why we're going into that is the whole thing. Mind, intelligence, false ego are actually just the mind. But within the category of mind, you have three divisions: mind, intelligence, and false ego. You understand? So therefore, of this, the mind is what you're trying to get at. The mind accepts the new concept of ego, that I'm not, you know, this body, but I'm servant of Krishna. Bingo. You don't convince the ego. The ego just is what it is. Ego is your existence. So how do you change that? The mind. Right? The intelligence can discriminate, you know, this is right, this is wrong, this is good, this is bad, this is, you know, hot, this is cold. But what will be done? How do you decide what's to be done? You have to accept and reject. I'll do this, I won't do that. Who does that? The mind. Yes.
Maharaj, here it looks like the mind is the central feature of the three. But then we often hear that the intelligence must be in the control of the mind. So what does that mean?
That means that the mind has to accept that what's intelligent is what it will do, rather than what it feels like it will do. Right? Does that make sense? Because still the mind will accept and reject. So in other words, the mind has accepted that I will do what it says in the philosophy, what is coming from authority, whether I like it or not. Because my mind may not like it, but I'll do it anyway. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? Like that. Yes?
Do computers have intelligence without your mind?
Do the intelligence have computers with no? Do intelligence? Do the computers have intelligence without mind? Depends upon what color it is. If it's golden, then there's a bit of a problem. But if it's not, if it's on if it's named HAL, also it's a problem. But any other computers? Yes, they are intelligence. You have to program what to accept and reject. That's why they can't find this whole concept that a computer could take over human beings. It can't. It's not possible. Because all they do, they're mathematical machines that discern commonalities and difference. This is all they do. They don't have an opinion. You have to program it with an opinion. In other words, you can put basically the function of mind into it. When this happens, then it does this. So it's able to discern that this is the situation. In that situation, then we do this. Does that make sense? When this electrical impulse comes over here, then you put an A on the screen there. But it's been programmed to do that, so it won't go outside of its programming. It's not going to this whole, because they don't know where consciousness comes from. Then they think it just happens. You know, it's just like you just have nothing, and this nothingness just exploded, and then all things for creation were just there, right? Stupid, but somehow or another they buy it, right? Then from all this chaos and everything, suddenly it all just came into perfect order. And then from perfect order, it developed consciousness. Right? So, and then it wanted to, you know, it was in the water and tired of being chased around by others, so it decided, hey, I'm out of here. And so then it grew feet and walked out on the land. Also lungs and that. You know, and then while it was out there, then it thought, you know, why I'm always here and people are stepping on me? I should have a little bit longer legs. You know, I should have some bigger mouth, teeth, so that when they get close, I can, you know, let them know who's boss. Or even better, hey, I can just fly. You know, does that make sense? So then the whole idea is that then that means that there's something conscious in the beginning. If nothingness can turn into this thing that walks around and thinks about this, then that means it had to have been conscious always. Otherwise, how do you How does it move? So they just bring it out of nowhere. They don't know. They have no idea. And so then all these little bits and pieces that are natural to the soul, thinking and loving, so all these things they put together. And then they come up with weirdo philosophies because they only have perception of this world. So without Shastra, they can't do very well. They can observe things and that, but it's always their stuff is going to be contradictory and it's not going to work. But the Vedic, it's contradictory, but it works if you know how to use it. That's the difference. Modern, if it's contradictory, doesn't work, you get rid of contradiction. So it works in one situation, but it absolutely fails in another. Well, the Vedic, you're able to work with the contradictory, so you can use it in both situations, so it will be successful in both. Yes?
Is there some relationship between someone that Amidala Prajna, mind intelligence, and ego? It seems like the ego is like the sambandha, like the relationship.
The ego,
it seems
yes.
Like the false
yes.
Sambandha and the activities, the intelligence, and the actual experiences in life.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's the way it goes. Because then your ignorance is your sambandha. In the material platform, your passion is your action. And your goodness is your result. Right? That's why when the situation is in the mode of goodness, the mind is peaceful. That's why a human being should situate himself in goodness. Right? Does that make sense? So, because the experience comes from there, that's also the feminine principle. So that's why when women are in an environment of goodness, then they prosper. Right? If they're in passion or ignorance, then it's too disturbing. You know what I'm saying? But the man can sit around in ignorance and be quite happy, because that's a masculine principle. Right? It's the perversion of existence. So existence here means ignorance. You only are here in the material because you're ignorant. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here. You'd be in the spiritual world. So therefore, the masculine can be in ignorance. So that then annoys the feminine because they're not conscious. They're insensitive. They're not aware, right? And then the man thinks the woman's being trippy. No, that's the mode of goodness, like that. I think it's illogical, but the point is it's a mode of goodness. You know what I'm saying? So it's the aspect of goodness, meaning the experience of it. Then there's the aspect of goodness, meaning the proper knowledge and activity, like that. But the mundane man makes the mistake of thinking that it's not practical because it's not mechanically efficient in getting the work done. Does that make sense? Right? It's not efficient in getting the work done. So therefore, it's seen that the feminine is illogical. Right? But the point is you're trying to get a particular experience, not get a particular thing done. You understand? So, therefore, that's why when the man is situated in the mode of ignorance like that, then nothing can work. So until their action is based on knowledge in the mode of goodness, not passion, they won't be successful. Right? Does that make sense? So all these things function on the spiritual platform all the way down to your, you know, basic, fundamental, mundane. It's the same principles. Everything's working off of this Sandini Samvit Ladini, because that's the application of the Swarup Shakti. The Swarup Shakti is manifesting through these three. And so when it's applied on the internal potency, right, then it manifests, you know, in one way, in the spiritual world, right? And when that's applied on the material world, then you get goodness, passion, and ignorance. You know what I'm saying? So it works in the spiritual world and it works in the material world. But because of this point, is as long as, you know, we can accept the Lord doesn't walk, but we can't accept the Lord walks. Therefore, you don't necessarily, you much of the time avoid comparing the material and spiritual. Because then they'll be make mistake will be, well, my dealing with the material in this way, I am spiritual. No, you're connecting it, you're spiritualizing it, it's not spiritual. You know what I'm saying? That's the thing. That's why these connections, then you have to be careful. Right? Yeah, then there'll be no difficulty. That's because then you're dealing with everything through knowledge. That's why the whole point is have knowledge, work with it. But it's not on the platform of just thinking. There is the loving aspect. So the thinking part is going to create the rules, the form, and everything like that. But the loving is going to create the experience, the spontaneity. So that's the thing. The man thinks as long as I've got it organized right, then it's done. No, that's the now you've got the field organized nicely. Now let's have some spontaneity. So if one's not spontaneous, means one's actually not that good. You know what I'm saying? If you're just learning to ride a bicycle, then you can't be spontaneous other than falling off or something, you know? In other words, you're just trying to get, so once you can, and when you can just ride it, then you can do. But someone who's very expert can do all kinds of things with the bicycle. You know what I'm saying? Same with cooking. You don't know, you just stick to the recipe, stick to the thing. Like, but once you're very expert, then you can start to combine things, create recipes, but it's all according to the formula. There's nothing outside the rule. This is the mistake. It's thought that spontaneous devotional service is outside the rule. No, it's exactly the rule, but the rule is being used in its ways to obtain what it's for. You know, we take the externality of it to be actual the rule. No, that's the basis of it. But the most important thing is what is the result that it gets? What's the experience that the rule gets? Therefore, if the situation changes, you know how to get that result of the experience, maybe not through that form. Therefore, it'll be seen as spontaneous. Does that make sense? So, when one is able to deal with all these things nicely, therefore, then he can be spontaneous. That's why the Brahmacharya ashram is very fixed, very rigid. They do all the different things. They become aware of what's going on. They become conscious because then all the practice is done. Otherwise, when he graduates, gets married, where's the time for practice? It doesn't exist. Therefore, now he will get through application, through experience. But he already understands the concept and its application. And he's good at it. He's a good Brahmachari. Therefore, now he'll use that same intelligence and apply it within the Grihastha ashram. Then he'll be expert.
On that sambandha, in the mind intelligence, ego, sambandha, abhidaya prajna, is that when we're using our intelligence in the abhidaya process?
Yeah, because knowledge is part of chit. So it's also there, situated in both. Because where abhidaya and sambandha meet, that's where the intelligence is being applied. Because it's in both. So that's prajumna, that's the interest to be involved. Because if you're not interested, you're not going to use the intelligence, you're not going to make the endeavor. Right? Is that okay?
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhakti Vrinda ki, Jai Nitai Gaura Premanandi.
Are there any registered students in the class here? Okay. Could we see you all just for a minute now?
I'm actually ready.
You're actually ready.
I just have to make it up.
Okay, no, that's fine. It's just a matter of that. You come soon. Okay, just wanting to just check and see, is that all this making some sense?
Yeah.
Huh? You understand what we're doing here? we've gone through the Ushupanishad, because, you know, there will be all the things Mataji's dealing with, all the essays and stuff like that. We've gone through the Ushupanishad in a chronological way, right? Just chapter by chapter. And what are the main points that are being done there? Now we're going through it and analyzing it, so then there'll be points that are being made by the acharyas that deal with it. So Upanishad, Ishupanishad, Upanishad, so therefore it has a formula like that, based on these five principles, right? So then that's being brought out here, and then going back and seeing how it's working in Ishupanishad. So we're looking at what Bhaktivinoda Thakur is saying about these 5 points, and then how that is there. Prabhupada is making some point about it in Ishupanishad. You see that? So the idea is that you're trying to put all those things together. It's one point, so wherever else it may be. Like there, it was in the introduction and in the fifth mantra. So chronologically, you wouldn't put those 2 points together, right? But it's being presented in a way that chronologically it makes sense, because the same point is there and it will develop. So in other words, chronologically, you get the development of the point, right? But analytical, then you get all the points together that may be presented how they were, you know, what's in the first chapter, what's in the second, like this. Sometimes the acharyas will even switch it, you know, because once you're looking at the whole thing, because then they'll put it in the order that works best for understanding the whole point, right? While the other way, they're putting it together how it will be best for building from one aspect to the next so you can actually get to the point. Does that make sense? Like you have the adhikarana, you have a point that's being made. Like these are all adhikaranas, right? So then that point that's being made then has so many sub-points is bringing up to it that make it complete so you understand it, right? Does that make sense? So this process being used, we'll use the same thing in Bhagavad Gita. We'll go through chronologically, then Srila Prabhupada's written an analysis of the Gita that will be according to these same kind of, you know, Vedantic principles. Then we'll study that, okay? Then Nectar Devotion, and we have to work that one out, exactly how that will be analytically studied, but the acharyas have written so many books based on Nectar Devotion, so there's a good chance we may use those as the analytical study. Then Upadeshamrita, then that's fairly straightforward. It's basically an analysis of Nectar of Devotion, so it'll be there, okay? Does this make sense how we're going through it? So you're trying to get the points that are here in this, and then trying to put together what's here. Most important is trying to catch what is the point being made. Right? It's not a matter of memorizing. If you can remember the points, that's really good. But the main point is understanding the points, and so that point can be elaborated, can be used in your life. Right? So the idea, the essay, is to tell if you've understood it. Does that make sense? That's why it's there. Otherwise, how are we going to know if you're catching the point? Right? So that's what's there. That's why the essays are short. You have to be able to get to the point immediately and present it very easily. Plus, it's very easy to put together a short essay. Right? If it's not, means you don't know what the point is. If it is, then it's just, you know what I'm saying? So that's the idea. That's why it's not a big, big elaborate things. No, because we're just dealing with it as it goes through. Does this make sense? So the idea is that therefore, we should be working with it, you know, and trying to keep up. But it doesn't matter. We've heard the thing. Ideally is that your studying of it and hearing of it and writing essays all go together. But if not, just as long as all three of them happened, you know, then that it works. Does that make sense? Yeah? Okay. And from September, it will be a little bit more structured, and that will work at a more specific speed, because from September, then what we're going to do is somehow or another arrange it, either close this class, and so only students are in it, or leave it open and only students can be involved. Others can listen, and unless they're very senior, then they can't ask questions. You know what I'm saying? So then we'll move at a speed so that make sure everybody does, because then we're going to be starting, like, we'll be working with Gita, so we're going to do whatever it is, you know, one chapter, two chapters a week. As it is now, it's because the whole concept is new, then, you know, we'll say one point, and we should be able to go through many points. We're going through it, you know, taking so many days, like that. But otherwise, it comes down, like in Bhagavatam, it'll be two chapters a week. That'll be the speed it works at. You know, so this is working at a slower pace, but the Bhagavatam, like we were doing second canto, we took, I think, a year and a half. but it's only 19 chapters, actually. No, it's less. 10. Yeah, so that technically should go down a lot quicker. Does that make sense? So, like that. Maybe. Yeah, because in our group, I think there's only 27 weeks. Yeah, so we have to be able to move through this very efficiently. So from September, we're going to try to move at a more efficient speed. Right? Because now we just have another, 5 weeks or something. So we're moving however we've been. Everyone's comfortable. And then everyone has 4 months to adjust that. You know, one, catch up like that. And two is that things will move faster. Like that. Okay? Everyone's comfortable with that? Anything they're not comfortable with? No. Okay. And hopefully next September we won't have any tractor. Jai. Srila Prabhupada ki. Samaveta Bhakta Vrinda ki. Jai Nitai Gaur Pranayana ki. Jai Ho.
I understood that.